Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for the dawn of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules, and at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. Welcome to another edition of Banal of America. Here we are continuing onward with the Summer of Strangeness. We've kept it going here. So far, so good. I'm pretty impressed. We haven't knocked off a week yet, so that's pretty good. And tonight I guess there was sort of an interesting sort of theme of this summer's offerings. I guess it would be that I'm trying to bring in some new voices, people we haven't talked to yet on the program before, or people we haven't talked to in a long, long time, like Vaney last week, or folks who were only on once, like Robert Schneck. New people, different people who have not been on Banal America before, but who are making an impact in the world of the paranormal in various realms. And so tonight, our guest is Chris Cogswell. He is the founder and host of the Mad Scientist Podcast, the wildly popular Mad Scientist Podcast. He has a PhD in chemical engineering with a focus on nanomaterials for absorption and separations. So he's a genuine, real-life scientist who has an interest in the strange and unusual. He's got a really popular podcast. He had a dalliance with MUFON, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, as we get into the program. He's a frequent tweeter. A lot of the folks who are having on the show this summer are folks I've encountered on Twitter, crossing paths with him. So I've enjoyed a lot of the content he puts out on Twitter, and I think we share a lot of the same opinions. So I said to myself, hey, let's get this Chris Cogswell on the show. Let's talk to him a little bit about what's going on in the world of the paranormal. So with all that said, welcome to the show, Chris Cogswell. Thanks for coming on Banal of America.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm super excited to come on.
Well, we start out generally with the new folks, with the bio, the background. You know, who is Chris Cogswell? How did you get interested in all this? And, tell us about your journey, if you will. Give us the background.
Sure, yeah. So, my family, I guess kind of it really starts with my family and my family background. So my my mom and my dad both were immigrants. My mom is originally from Italy, and my dad is from the strange and exotic country of Canada. Very weird. But they both my parents kind of had very non-traditional, backgrounds and grew up in families where the strange and unusual was sort of not really commonplace, but I guess a little bit accepted or talked about a little bit more. And my mom especially, when I was growing up, my mom was really into things like astrology and, UFO stories and horror movies and all those kinds of cool things. And so that really kind of got me interested in it. But at the same time, my family was also very very settled and very strong in the idea that, a good education, academic background, all of those sorts of things were really important. For my family, the best job you could have was, a doctor or a professor, right? Like that was,
right.
Those were like the de facto jobs you wanted to have, or a teacher of some sort, Those are the kinds of things. So education and knowledge was always really important. And so I always, as a kid growing up, you get interested in these topics and you hear more about them and stuff. And like any inquisitive kid, I think you want to know, is there truth to some of this, right? Like you kind of instinctively want to know, if any of this holds any water. And for me, that kind of developed into, I guess, a lifelong obsession with the question of, you know, frankly, why do people believe weird things sometimes? And do any of those weird things have reality behind them? So, you know, the kind of common example I give is my grandma growing up. She was super into like science and history and medicine, and was really knowledgeable about all these things. And it was always great talking to her about that stuff. But then when you got into certain topics, her mindset just like went off the rails, you know? So, so an example of that is she got diabetes as an older woman, and I don't know where she picked this up, but for some reason she picked up a myth that if you put lemon juice on sweet things, it would negate the sugar and make it okay for you to eat if you're diabetic.
So weird.
Which wasn't true, right? And like, thank God my grandma generally ate pretty healthy, because there were times where she'd be getting, you know, like an ice cream sundae and then sprinkling lemon juice on it, being like, no, it's okay. Now the body doesn't realize it's sugar. You know, and you're sitting there like, you know, you're 15 years old, you're kind of a little punk kid, and you're like, you know, grandma, that's so stupid, what are you doing? And she's like, you know, don't talk to me like that, Christopher, right? So, So that's kind of, I guess, where the desire to know answers to that came from. And as a kid, my family had a lot of experiences that I guess people would, if I had been raised in another household, I think people would have considered them to be paranormal. So an example, I can give you an example of this. My dad, my dad was very, very sick when I was a kid. And the first sign of his sickness was he was having hallucinations at night from lack of oxygen, right? He developed sleep apnea. And so I'll never forget, this was like right after I just got into horror movies about aliens and everything else. And he started talking about seeing or speaking to an animal that was in the trees outside, right? And,
oh, wow.
And anyone who's listening to the show, you yourself know, that's like a really common part of the UFO lore now, right, is they show up as – or some versions of the UFO lore, I guess I should say, they show up as owls and they sit outside your window and, you know, all that kind of spooky stuff. And so if I had been raised differently, I would probably still today consider that to have been – a paranormal experience, as opposed to just like, you know, my dad's brain being like, you know, please give me oxygen, right?
Right.
So those kinds of things were always fascinating to me, always a big thing. When I got to school for an undergraduate degree, I did chemical engineering, which is kind of my first degree, but I also did philosophy, and a lot of my philosophy research focused on that same question, like, why do people believe some things that are scientific and some things that are not scientific? Why do people deny science in some cases, but rather take on like conspiracy theories or, you know, pseudoscientific beliefs or whatever, but also the related question of why does science ignore, certain subjects, right? Like why does science ignore a whole class of people who claim that they've had, UFO experiences, right? That to me is a really interesting question. And so I graduated from undergrad. I went to go get my PhD at Northeastern in chemical engineering, focusing, like you said, on nanomaterial synthesis for different applications. And in grad school, I decided to start the podcast. And that kind of really kicked it off for me. You know, that was where I started getting, you know, talking to people who were involved in more of this subject, speaking to people who had experiences, who had seen things, who thought that something real had happened to them. And really how I got involved, frankly, with MUFON was by talking to these experiencers and, you know, I guess having them tell me their stories and be really affected by them and hear how, you know, really deeply moved and frankly, how damaged some of these experiences could – how much damage these experiences could do to them. And thinking, you know, there's a whole class of people who – their only recourse is to go to people who want to sell them, you know, healing crystals and junk like that, right?
Yeah.
They're being exploited. So I felt that I should, if I could, at least help in some way or get an answer or, even just kind of steer them towards evidence-based approaches, right? Like what will actually help their symptoms, even if it can't answer that underlying question of, like, you know, what happened to you? At the very least, we can actually help these people in a, you know, in a good way, right? It's like a medically good and ethical way.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's,
yeah.
That's kind of where, I don't know, that's the long story.
That's the origin
how
story.
How
I'm
involved
right.
in this. Yeah.
Now, at the risk, I guess we'll just dive into the MUFON thing, because that's kind of like, it was just sort of an interesting turn of events, because I remember you came on board MUFON, and it was kind of a big thing. Everyone was, like, really interested in what you were going to do, but it was a very short-lived association. So I guess give us sort of the rundown on that, and then I'll kind of pepper you with some questions. What exactly happened there? I'm kind of familiar with what did happen, but tell the people what happened, because it's a little inside baseball, but it's also like this show is a lot of inside baseball, so I think people will appreciate it.
Yeah, no, for sure, man. I mean, you know, that's one thing too with everything that I've tried to do in these fields is, it's one of the funny kind of, I guess, ironies of being involved in these sorts of things, right? On the one hand, you have people who believe in UFOs or believe in these things saying, you know, the government is hiding secrets from all of us and they're, you know, terrible secret keepers and there's people who want to know. And then you ask them, like, well, where's your evidence? They're like, I can't tell you. It's a secret. You know, I'm a secret keeper. I can't tell you that. So for me, I try to be as open and transparent as possible, right? So my resignation letter from MUFON is online. All my reasons are online. We talk about it on the podcast. But essentially what happened was, so I was doing the show, and I was kind of, you know, I tend to look at these things skeptically, and I think also just tend to I hedge my – I guess not to really hedge my views, but my views sort of align with the idea that even if some of this is real, right, even if we accept that there is a reality to UFOs or any of these things, ghosts, the afterlife, whatever – it's probably true that 99% of those events are misreported or hoaxes or errors or whatever, right? They're probably rare. They're probably exceedingly rare. And so that view and that take on this has not made me a lot of friends in this field. but, you know, I think it's the most sensible viewpoint you can take, right? Like, you know, like Socrates said, the only thing that we can be sure of is that we don't know anything, right? The only thing I know is I know nothing. And that's, I think, absolutely true for this field. So when I was doing the podcast, I was talking about this kind of stuff, and I was talking to more and more experiencers, and a lot of people were saying, you know, why don't you get involved with MUFON? They are really hurting. They are looking for a new director of research, and, you know, it just might be a good fit. And so I initially basically decided, like, I should put my money where my mouth is, right? I'm on this show every week saying, oh, it'd be so cool if scientists got involved in the UFO subject or whatever. And, you know, I'm a guy with a PhD who wasn't getting involved. I'll do it, right? So, yeah, so I decided to send an email and see if I could talk to somebody in the area. I was in Minnesota at the time, and see if I could talk to anybody at the local chapter. And surprisingly enough, I got a call back from the head of MUFON saying that he wanted to talk and, you know, was really excited to have me join and all this other stuff. So it was kind of I was kind of lucky, and I was really happy to have that sort of welcome. And in speaking to them and speaking to Jan Harzan and kind of getting to know the team and everyone else at MUFON, I felt like it felt like there was a genuine effort to revitalize what MUFON was doing and what it could do. You know, the way MUFON runs now, it's sort of very, it's like a franchise model, right? When you run a fast food franchise location, you get to kind of borrow like the name and the logo and everything else. But at the end of the day, they're not really doing anything for you, right? Like, you're right. Buying all the stuff you sell from McDonald's. You know, they're not sending you patties for free.
They're sending the promotional materials and shit every month or whatever.
Exactly, right? Yeah. And that's the way MUFON works, is you have a local chapter, And the local chapter, they basically are self-funded, right? Like, MUFON doesn't send them money. They don't send them materials on training to do investigations. They don't send them any of that stuff, right? Like, any materials or tools or people or anything.
But right. Frankly, actually, in a lot of cases, the money goes the other way. So the people who were training and stuff have to pay MUFON to be trained and stuff. So it's not even dare I say, more like a pyramid scheme than a restaurant franchise. But it's interesting setup. Let's put it that way.
It is an inverted cone method, okay, Tim? Let's pyramid is a hard word. It's an ancient alien structure method. Structure, right? But no, but it's true though, right? Like, at the end of the day, the things that the investigators get for being members of MUFON is kind of the name and the electronic structure that exists behind the MUFON case database. Right, they have a place to put their cases. They have a place to put their records. They have a place to talk about this stuff. And in many ways, like, it's not dissimilar to the way that scientific journals work or conferences or things like that. So, anyways, so I thought we could do some really cool stuff with MUFON. I was really excited, and we were starting to do cool stuff. We were starting to analyze their case database, working with some statisticians to figure out a way to clean the data and make it make it capable of being analyzed in any interesting or kind of significant way. Anyone can run numbers through Excel, but those aren't necessarily statistically valid because of the quality of the information in the data set, right? So it's that's a problem that has to be dealt with. At the same time, we were working on other things, trying to get more scientists involved, trying to get a team of folks together to figure out, what is the profile of a good case? What's the profile of a bad case? Stuff like that. And unfortunately, I was kind of shocked to find out that I'm going to go back a little bit. One of the kind of baseline things that I wanted to know before I joined was essentially, has MUFON, because MUFON is a very shady shady is maybe the wrong word. It has a very spotty record when it comes to vetting people, the people who are in leadership, all the scandals, all the things your listeners know about, right?
Yeah,
I'm
exactly.
Sure.
Yeah.
So I was pretty concerned lending my voice and kind of support in any way to an organization that I thought maybe I can't really stand behind them, or maybe I don't feel comfortable. So I kind of filled around and tried to make sure, like, all that racism crap is done, right? All that sexism stuff is done. All the cult leader stuff is done. And was assured it was, and it looked like it was to my eye. And then lo and behold, I find out that the root of the problem wasn't just an individual. It was more of a culture at certain – it seems like it's a culture at certain – again, MUFON is more of a franchise organization, right? So
yeah.
I don't necessarily think the problem exists at Central MUFON per se. I think that instead Central MUFON has sort of thrown up their hands and said, we have no way of controlling this. And we're never going to be able to control the people who do this. So we're just going to stay out of it and let them keep giving us money. And I didn't feel comfortable being a part of that, and so I decided to resign. Essentially, I gave MUFON an ultimatum. I said, if I will stay on board if you get rid of this person. It was the same person as the first, racism explosion that happened, and was told essentially that, they didn't feel like it was in their power or even in their – it was even a thing they felt required to do to strip that person of membership or control in setting up the conference or any of those things. So I decided, Not a big fan of racism, so I'm not going to be part of that organization anymore.
yeah, it's a very – I commend you for that. I don't even know his name, so I'm not – I'm not the guy we're talking about, but a different guy. But there was someone who did made a grandstand exit from MUFON when this first happened and then quietly rejoined 6 months to a year later. So it's like – come on, man. Come on, man. Don't fucking do that. So I commend you, I commend you for sticking to your guns and leaving and actually, unless you're, I don't think you're secretly working for them now. So this isn't even a secret. This guy's just like, yeah, I'm back with MUFON. They're the only game in town. So what can I do? Not fucking be a part of it.
Dude, that's the problem. That's the challenge. It's like they really are the only game in town. And it's like if you want to, no matter who you talk to, every single major researcher is affiliated with MUFON in some way. You know what I mean? There's just it's like they're too big to fail. It's like the banks.
Yeah.
It's a crazy situation, and it's like they don't even have those many, that many members. Like it's not like it's a megalith of people, right? And that's why it's kind of cool, or I think it's kind of interesting that groups like, groups like, say, To the Stars Academy, or even just like UFO Twitter, like people are super active on Twitter that are involved in UFOs.
Yeah.
We don't necessarily always get along, but they're talking and they're thinking and they're finding cool stuff. And you know what I mean? Like, there are cool things happening that are outside of the purview or scope of MUFON. I think the challenge is that for most experiencers, for most people who think they've had a kind of continuous problem with these events or whatever, there is no other outlet for them to tell their stories. So if you want to work with those people, if you want to talk to those people, you're kind of forced to go through that swamp. You know what I mean? And it's just so frustrating.
Yeah, it's interesting because I don't know the exact details. You know who would know is our buddy Jack Brewer, but I don't know the exact details of how this all went down. But I was going to say there was another guy who came in to MUFON with a lot of big ideas, James Carrion. I remember when he came on board, and it was kind of – and I don't – he didn't leave for the same reasons you did, but it was a very similar kind of trajectory where it's like, all right, I'm in, and now, we're going to – I think the whole thing was like, we're going to get this up and running for the 21st century was sort of like his thing. And within like a year or two, he was out. And he became like a pretty hardened skeptic about the whole UFO phenomenon in general. So it's like, MUFON is just, they're who they are, and they're not really going to really change too much. If the whole organization feels very antiquated, just feels kind of like very, almost in a sense too, like a mutual desperation society where MUFON's like, hey, this is the best we can get. These are the people, and I'm not dissing the people who are in MUFON because there's a lot of cool folks who are in MUFON, but like you were saying before, it's like, they're like, hey, we can't control these people, so what they do is what they do. And the people who are on the local level and everything, they don't really have any, like I said before about the guy there that I don't know the name of, they don't have anywhere else to go if they want to investigate these things. So it's like I said, it's a mutual desperation society almost, or something.
No, absolutely. It's a huge sort of – it's just such a big challenge because if – so MUFON's members tend to be older. They tend to be whiter than the population, right? I mean, they tend to be more conservative in their views generally. So it is sort of an antiquated organization. I don't think that's necessarily by design, but I think it is, kind of by demographics, right? Like that's just kind of the way that those viewpoints are going to go. And the biggest or the hardest thing for me, at least, is trying to figure out a way or finding ways again to, because there are good people in MUFON. You know what I mean?
Absolutely,
there are good people there as part of that group. So how do you work with them? But get around those issues, or can you?
Yeah, it's a very tricky thing, and it's funny in a way because like when I got into this, like almost 20 years ago, everybody was kind of the attitude of a lot of people was that like, MUFON's on the way out, MUFON's dying, and everything. But it's like MUFON's been dying now for like 20 years; it's still somehow still around. So I don't quite know what to make of it.
When I'm on my, it's like that old, it really is. It's there every time that something looks like it's going to be kind of the end for it, because there is no other alternative, that sort of it stays because there's nothing else, you know. People don't feel like there's any other good place to talk about this or come up with those ideas or, I don't know, just think about them generally. And it's such a shame because there are good forums to do that, right? You don't need MUFON to investigate UFOs, right? Like, you don't need MUFON to go out there and talk to people about their experiences or go to the conferences or any of those things. So I don't know, man. Yeah, it's a very strange situation because I think at the end of the day, like you said, they're going to be around. You know, there's a lot of money behind MUFON, and frankly, the database they've built is – the database of cases they've built is not necessarily, I think, useful for looking at the actual state of, like, UFOs, right? Like, that database can't tell you what a UFO looks like. What that database, though, can tell you is what do people who report UFOs think a UFO looks like, right? Because there's no way of discerning a good case from a bad case. So even the data they've collected is mainly kind of a moot, you know, it's not answering the question they want to answer. So it's kind of it's just a weird, I don't know, man. It's just a weird circle, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I always found it kind of interesting that it was like, because I met a few people from MUFON last year. It was like the closest I mean, I've known people in MUFON for years, but this was like, we kind of had a chance to sit down and talk a little bit about what the organization's like and everything. And it's very, like, it's just something I'm not really, I can't almost wrap my head around. This is like the case with a lot of people in the field and a lot of their passions, in a sense, because I feel like I'm more of an observer of all this. But it's like some of these folks, they get the call, they distribute the cases, whatever. Like, let's say you're the South Dakota MUFON, if you're one of the investigators, if you've taken the tests and everything, then you're tasked with going out and interviewing the person and you know, trying to get in the sketches and study, investigating all the cases and stuff. And to me, it's like, I don't really – that's a lot of fucking work, fucking work, dude, for the – to show it's the ISS or whatever. So I always was like, I like the idea of having a place to go every month and talking about this kind of stuff, but – to me, I guess people like that. People like doing the investigations, but it never really clicked it with me where it was like, oh, that sounds like a lot of fun. It sounds like more boring than a ghost hunt.
I think people like the idea of doing the investigations when they think it's going to be like, you know, Mulder and Scully going out there and you talk to somebody and then a craft flies overhead and you're like, oh my God. Or like, that's what people want to think this is like. They don't want to think it's, you know, walking around a field in 30 degree weather with a crappy cell phone camera, taking pictures of, you know,
the
backyard of some guy who's like, yeah, you know what I mean? Like, it's largely not interesting. It's largely challenging. It's largely hard to do. And frankly, I think that's also partly why MUFON is able to exist is because they have been able to find people willing to do that work. You know,
yeah.
Like if it weren't for MUFON, really, we wouldn't know. I mean, not that MUFON really shares their cases in any kind of vocally public way, but if it weren't for MUFON and MUFON investigators, we wouldn't know a lot about modern UFO sightings, you know, and modern UFO cases, because you'd get the stuff that makes its way to the internet and, you know, whatever. But in terms of kind of like a large scale data set and collection of that info and stuff, that's only coming from MUFON. So, I mean, you know, it's hard. I'm a person who feels like if you love something, you should be critical of it so that it can get better, you know?
Yeah.
I always give the example of, you know, I'm a hockey guy, so I love the New York Rangers. But the New York Rangers are a terrible hockey team. They're a terrible hockey organization. They have been since I've been a kid. You know what I mean? So, but I love them. You know what I mean? I go to the games. I have loads of jerseys. I have the posters for a team that can't win, you know, a game, right? So there's – I think that's the kind of mindset people need to have about a lot of this in some ways is – if you love this subject, if you think there's something cool here, if you yourself feel like you had an example of an experience, You know, shouldn't you want – you should be the person fighting the hardest to get rid of all of the crap. You know, all the stuff that makes you look like a kook, all the stuff that makes this subject look stupid and silly and, you know, just terrible. You know, you should be trying to get rid of that stuff. But instead, a lot of people have taken, I think, you know, frankly, the MUFON approach, which is there's just too much crap, so we got to sit in it. You know? It's a terrible approach. It's a terrible way of looking at things.
Yeah, exactly. Because I think also, yeah, nobody wants to spearhead the creation of a new MUFON if they're, you know, if they're like a disenfranchised MUFON member or whatever. They just want to go out to that field and look at the tree line and shit. So they don't really, there's a certain skill set for each thing, I think. And it's like you need someone with a lot of time and interest in organizing something like that. And I don't know too many people who do that.
What's funny actually is, so I actually just this week, announced that I've taken on the director of science position for SkyHub, which is a group of really, really smart people, computer programmers and software developers and just folks that know their stuff, who are developing an open source platform to make essentially detection devices that can go in your backyard or on your house or in a room or whatever. And they connect to the internet, and all of that data that gets collected gets uploaded if you want it to. And essentially it's like it's 24/7 tracking of the sky from a certain location, right? If there's things up there, you're going to see them on this damn camera, you know? That doesn't, you know, and it doesn't require a lot of – I mean, it requires a lot of work and a lot of kind of that structural work you're talking about. But I think there's a lot of cool ideas out there right now where people are trying to think of ways to get around the MUFON problem of how do we collect data – first off, how do we collect data in a strong way that doesn't require an investigator who maybe is undertrained, is trained badly, or even if they're really well trained, just get something wrong, right? Like, how do we remove that factor of human error from the whole system, while still allowing people who want to be into this stuff and want to give their time and effort to be able to build a unit, put it in their house, put it outside, whatever. And then collect data, you know. So that's, I think there's a lot of cool ideas out there for stuff like that. And we're not the only group doing a kind of scalable system where you can kind of do some stuff like this. But I think it's going to be really cool, man. I think cool things are around the corner, you know.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Don't fall into the disclosure trap, though.
It's going to happen. Aliens are going to be on the cover of the New York Times. It's all coming down the pipe.
Oh, my God. Let's hope they have a cure for the coronavirus. Otherwise, I don't know why the fuck they want to show up here.
Right, I don't want them.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's interesting. I'd have to revisit what he talked about with me, like, shit, almost over a decade ago. Peter Davenport was talking about sort of a passive radar system. This is way before really cell phones and apps and all that stuff, way before the technology had sort of advanced. But I think not necessarily what you guys are doing, but something kind of along the lines of that, like sort of a sweeping sort of scan of the sky by having individual smaller stations around the country or something like that. So it's definitely, you know, a viable concept for sure.
Yeah, I think the big challenges of anything like this are going to be scalability and also, you know, the best case scenario is you have enough sensors deployed across the United States or across a single state or, you know, a town, whatever, that you could actually get usable data that can be coordinated all together, right? So if you had a really strong array of these things and a really good hold on all of that land and whatever, then you could, in theory, do something like, you know, we see an event happening on this camera and this grid. Do we see that same event on these other cameras that should be able to pick up the same image, right?
Yeah.
Do we see any changes in the magnetic fields or pressure or temperature or, you know, any of these other things, right? Humidity, like, are there changes being picked up that might be of interest? And that's kind of, I think, really the best way we're going to get the best way we're going to get any kind of answers here, because, again, otherwise all you're doing is sort of measuring the perception of the observer. And that's
right,
true of any
right.
kind of sociological or any kind of time anytime you survey people about something, you're implicitly also measuring their biases and their own opinions and their ideas that kind of get away from the data itself. So trying to find a way to separate those is a challenge. And I think part of that challenge is going to be the scalability of the system, but also, frankly, the ability to, I think our ability technologically to have right now, we are talking, I'm talking to you through what 10 years ago would have been considered the most sophisticated computer in the world. it seems like technology is on the progression that eventually something like that or something that could help us kind of answer these questions by using big data, big data is kind of the wrong buzzword, I guess, but something to answer this by being able to deploy technology in more sophisticated ways. It seems like it's just a matter of time. And of course, scientists have been wrong about that for a very long time, right? We thought we would be curing all diseases, 100 years ago, right? It was just a matter of time then, and here we are. So, scientists are wrong sometimes in the forever prescient words of Mac from It's Always Sunny. But, I think, again, science and sort of these questions and people's perception of these questions seem to be coming to a head, and whether or not that means that, these questions will be answered in a way that I think the disclosure advocates would be happy with, or it means that we go through another one of these kind of cycles where a pseudoscientific idea gets kind of pushed aside and shrunk in its importance. I don't know. I think either one of those is going to happen. It's going to be interesting. I doubt the status quo will be maintained.
Yeah, it's interesting. So kind of like the idea of the thing you're working on, almost like akin to like when somebody robs a bank or whatever, then they go and like grab all the different cameras from down the street. So it's like, well, this one might show half the license plate, and then this one might give us a look at the guy's face, so you can kind of piece together what just happened as the bank robber was driving away by the different camera perspectives down the street almost.
Exactly. Yeah. Another analogy here would be something. I mean, that's the perfect analogy. You're 100% correct. That's kind of the idea, right? The other idea too is that if you're able to collect, like for example, right? Right now we have a lot of videos that come online where, half the people on YouTube are saying that's a drone, and then you got like one guy who's like that's a space station, and another guy who's saying well that's a plane, and then you got a million people saying, like, I bet it's an alien. We don't actually have a good understanding or a good answer to the question of, like, well, what is a drone – what are the limits of what a drone can do on a camera system, right? Because people are taking pictures from different cameras, from different locations. Everything is different. We don't know the temperature, the pressure. We don't know any of the other stuff. The idea here is not only to get a bunch of different data points – at different locations, but also to have them coming through the same types of sensors so that all those questions, right? What does a drone look like on this camera versus that camera? Well, we're using one, we're using one sort of device, right? And the goal eventually is to be able to, use some of our, programming skills and our mathematics and our sort of just analysis skills to figure out, well, hey, this is what a drone looks like. Right, so here's some stuff that maybe someone maybe somebody who's really smart and really good at this can hoax a UFO event in some way that tricks all of us and everything else. But what they won't be able to do, or what we hope won't be able to do, is trick some of those underlying mathematical trends that we notice.
Yeah.
So I'll give you an example, right, from medicine. Diseases that are real versus diseases that are not real, that are psychologically based, And I don't mean that psychological diseases aren't real in any way, right? Like, mental illness is very real and requires treatment and everything else. But what I'm talking about are things like, you know, electromagnetic sensitivity syndrome, right? That are based on all of our medical science appear to just be a form of obsessive compulsive disorder, right? Or an anxiety disorder. Diseases like that have no physical basis or seem to have no physical basis behave differently in the statistics than diseases that do have a physical, environmental, or chemical basis.
Interesting.
You know, the same thing is true for, you know, diseases that, you know, how they spread through populations, right? There are kind of trends that we notice in the underlying math of those cases that suggest that this is a real thing versus this is a fake thing, right? Or this is a hoax, or this is someone making up that they're sick or whatever. So one of the answers I always give, or one of the things that I think is so interesting with all of this UFO stuff is, okay, one person maybe can hoax a single event, but 10,000 people hoaxing very similar events that have very similar underlying trends to them that seem to fit statistically, that I think is much harder.
Yeah.
And that's frankly what I pitched to MUFON, was this idea that if this is a real event, then there should be something, there should be some statistically relevant trends we can pull out of the data, right? There have to be, because if they're not physical events, if they're not events that are happening in any real way, or even psychological events that are happening in some real way to people that are experiencing them, then,
yeah.
I mean, if you can't measure them, then they're just belief, and then you don't need a stupid science guy, right? You need a priest. So chill, right? I'm done.
Exactly, exactly.
So there's just like – there's a lot of cool – stuff. There's a lot of interesting science. There's a lot of very – the academic pedigree of some of these questions is very long and very very important, frankly, you know?
Yeah.
But the UFO subject kind of ignores all of that stuff because, you know, there's a guy saying that he worked on spacecraft at Area 51, and that guy's cooler.
Yeah, that's all that academic stuff. Exactly. Yeah. It's interesting – it's an interesting world. I alternate between, like, rolling my eyes and kind of shaking my head in disgust at the super fans, and then also kind of, like, finding them oddly endearing in a way, you know, because they get so excited about this shit, and it's like, oh, my God, you're really into UFOs. Wow.
It's funny.
So,
I know. You know, man, it's so it's funny on the times that kind of like the group agrees with you, and then suddenly you're like a hero on, you know, the UFO internet or whatever.
Yeah.
Or any of these things. Like, I think it's with any kind of fandom, right? It's like when people really agree with you and, you know, want to kind of promote your ideas or promote your stories or whatever, it feels really affirming. You know, it feels good to be part of the crowd. And then when they don't, it feels terrible, you know, like it's not fun. And that's also a problem with this stuff is it's because a lot of people, I think, accept that there is no, like, because a lot of people accept or think right now that there's no underlying reality to any of this stuff in any, I don't want to say any underlying reality. What I mean, I guess, is that a lot of this is metaphysics. It's like, you know, a lot of people today seem to believe that a UFO event should be treated the same way that you treat a religious event. So, you know, just like if someone came to me and said, I think I saw the Virgin Mary in a dream and she talked to me and it made me change my life for the better. You know, what do you say to that? Like, you know, no, that probably didn't happen and you shouldn't have changed your life for the better. Right. Like, that's terrible. Right. So
right.
Just like I think that they feel that people take a hands-off approach when it comes to other belief systems like religion, they believe that the same kind of hands-off approach should play in with UFO belief. And I just don't buy that. You know what I mean? If they want it to be treated like a science, then it's going to be critiqued. It's going to be attacked. It's going to be broken apart. You know, people won't just
– Yeah.
No scientist ever said, I just believe this because it's how I feel. And other scientists were like, oh, cool.
Right, exactly.
I feel that way too. You know, that's not the way it works.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's very much a matter of faith with a lot of folks, and it's just interesting. There's like, and I'm not even saying necessarily kind of like what you were saying about this being an unreality or whatever, but to me it's like, our present reality that I think we can all kind of mostly agree on is like, to me, more pressing than whatever the UFO thing is. I've said the last few weeks on the show, it's like, I would love to know what UFOs are. I always advocated, you know, that they should tell us just because I'd like to know. I mean, that's for no other reason. It would be kind of fun to find out. But it's like, now it's not. People are going to listen and be like, oh, fuck, it goes banal on the soapbox again. Now's not the time for UFO disclosure. That's my take on that. If things settle
so
down,
funny,
we can get our fucking act together as a country, like in the next 2 years, you know, maybe it may take another couple of years. Who knows? If we that might be miraculous. I don't know. But, you know, I don't think we need to get our shit together here before we can deal with the complexity of that. When people can't agree to wear a fucking mask in the middle of a pandemic, introducing aliens and, you know, visitors from the future or another dimension or wherever the fuck they come from, it's like none of that is tenable with the current state of our world right now. That's just kind of how I feel. Because I've seen these arguments where it's like, everyone's going to stop and fucking realize and unite as human earthlings. And it's like, no, they won't, dude. Like, you're living in a fucking dream world. Like, people aren't, they won't unite. If we can't unite over a fucking pandemic that's killing people, hundreds of thousands of people every day, like, what makes you think we're going to unite over fucking aliens? No, it's not going to happen.
I think a lot of people believe, like, it's actually really funny. I was talking to somebody last night, and they asked me if the government came out and said, we know there's a lot going on right now, but we thought this would be, like, a time to mention this or whatever. Like, aliens are real, right? If the Senate came out and said aliens are real, what would be my response? And I said that my response would be to, if I was, you know, ever to ask the Senate anything, I would ask them what terrible shit are you hiding?
Right.
Like, what are you trying to get me to not pay attention to? That you're like, oh, aliens are real right now, yo. Like, guess what? Aliens are real. And then, you know, another 100,000 people die from COVID.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It is not, I agree with you completely. It's not the time. And people sort of, you know, I often wonder what, again, a lot of these ideas have been kind of considered and thought about for a really long time, you know. One of the most influential philosophers, love him or hate him, of, you know, the history of philosophy was Karl Marx, right? And Marx had this idea about technological, it wasn't just Marx that had this, Engels also kind of promoted this, and then today it's gone into a field of kind of study called futurism. But they had this idea that technology and economics are inextricably linked, and that economics kind of determines the technology that's accepted and vice versa. So the famous quote is that, you know, the feudal system had the cart and wagon, and capitalism has the steam engine, right? That the ability to transport goods, the ability to use energy in a more efficient way, meant suddenly that you no longer had to have power centralized in these small places where it was, you know, 100 people under one ruler in little kind of fiefdoms. Right now, with the steam engine, you could have societies that traded with each other and moved information and materials and everything else across much bigger places. And so you could have kind of these larger capitalist countries, right? Like, you know, the United States and France and Europe or England and, you know, the European Union and all these other groups, right? And the idea of the idea of alien technology coming down and giving us free energy, right? If aliens are able to if aliens are able to travel the stars and get here to Earth, that suggests that they are able to do kind of two things that would immediately shatter the world, like to the world as we know it, right?
Right.
The first one is they are able to – first off, they're able to travel distances that seem impossible to us, and so they're able to exist – they're able to live that long, right? Like how are they able to extend their lives to travel distance and that time? And the second one is they have – they must have access to an extremely efficient fuel source, right? Because otherwise, how are they actually getting the fuel to travel here over that extended distance? And that, that extended time. If we had access to a fuel like that, think about how everything would change, right?
Yeah.
It would no longer cost you any money, essentially, to travel or to transport anything across the surface of the Earth, right? So suddenly you have people who are moving from very, very poor locations, locations without good agricultural or water resources, to places that are very rich in those resources. You have people who are able to now transport very luxury goods that otherwise would not be able to travel or not be able to be given to some places for almost no money, right? The world economy would collapse immediately.
Exactly.
If we had access to that kind of energy fuel, right? And so, you know, there's kind of a big debate going on right now about whether or not these aliens are harmful to us or not. Do they mean to do us harm, or would they be benevolent or whatever? But the part of that that's always kind of ignored is they may not mean us harm, but they will change us, right? Like they would necessarily change us. And although that change might be really good for some people, you know, the ability to access free energy in that way would be, or nearly free energy, would be really, really great for the poor of the world. Frankly, it probably wouldn't be very good for the rich. You know, it would not be very good for the United States, you know, in terms of geopolitics and control and everything else. It would, you know, so I think there's kind of a question overall of, or I think a naivety of thinking that, you know, the threat is only physical. The threat is only that aliens would come down with laser beams or, you know, crap like that, right? Like,
yeah.
It is a legitimate change in worldview and thought process, and it would upend our lives as we know them completely. You know, it would just change everything. And so to think that could happen, and it would, you know, to think that would happen and it would only bring positive things, like maybe in 100 years, things would kind of go back to normal. But think about what happens now when transport gets really easy across borders, right? We have refugees, we have immigrants that come to countries, and then there's big problems with people not wanting those immigrants or, you know, any of those kinds of things, you know, when trade routes fall apart, like with this pandemic, you know, one supply chain stopped working and it ruined the American economy. You know,
exactly.
The world would not be good right after an alien visitation or alien disclosure.
Right. Yeah. It's a very, I hammer that a lot on the show, in a sense, just that it's like, I don't think a lot of people think through the logistics of this. Like, they just go, oh, they're going to tell us about the truth about UFOs and aliens. But it's like, okay, then what? Then what's going to happen, dude? Like, as I said multiple times on the show recent weeks, like, we can't, you know, aside from going out to the space station, which is like going down to the gas station, it's like we can't leave here. So what they're going to come here or something like that, I don't know. But it's like it doesn't seem like the logistics are very well thought out. It's just like, just tell us the truth, and we'll deal with it after that. It's like, fucking, I don't know, dude. I'd rather just maybe try and figure it out on our own or something here, you know? Because it's I feel like having this knowledge foisted upon the human race is maybe maybe dangerous, maybe not well thought out. So, like you said, if they said that, it would be like, part of me would be like, okay, what the hell is, all right, why are you telling us this now? You know, are they coming here to fucking eat us? Like, why are you preparing us for this revelation all of a sudden?
What's 2020 going to bring? Right, what else can 2020 do to us?
Yeah, exactly. I always thought, like, the best way to do this, and I always thought, like, it still could happen, would be for them to be like, send somebody to Mars, and then they're like, oh, we found like, ruins. So that way you're like, okay, you know, there's aliens, but they must have died a long time ago. But this tells us that they existed. So that maybe they're out there somewhere. But so it's kind of like a half step into the disclosure thing. That's been my preferred form of disclosure in a way. But I feel like they could pull that off pretty easily, you know. But whether they want to or not, who knows?
Hmm.
What's now, I got a question for you.
Go ahead.
I have many questions. I host the show, so I should have questions. but your background makes you ideal for what me and my friends like to call the alien alloys, which a lot of, I think, what are they called now? The meta materials. I liked it better when they were alien alloys, as they were described in the New York Times in the now infamous article. And I guess, sort of, I like to keep things on a very. I like to say, like, I'm like the Dusty Rhodes of paranormal podcasting. I just like to keep it on the at level of the common man here. So, like, I guess my question basically is based on your scientific background, like, how easily, if I brought you a piece of metal and I was like, hey, Chris, you know, I think this came from a flying saucer. Can you, how easy is it to actually figure out if it actually came from a flying saucer? I kind of will use the example in a sense of, my friend Tyler Cokejohn, I don't know if you know Dr. Tyler Cokejohn, he's into a lot of this stuff too. Yeah, he's a great dude. He's more in the medical realm, and you know, he said, like, a lot of these folks were like, oh, I'm an alien hybrid, or these ladies who were like, you know, and my heart breaks for them, don't get me wrong, who say, like, they had a baby and the baby was taken by an alien. He said, like, that there's medical tests they can do to confirm whether or not any of these scenarios actually happen. Like, they can look at your DNA and figure out if you have some kind of a abnormality in your DNA that would suggest that you're a hybrid or whatever, you know, or that you had an alien baby. You know, some people think, oh, I was abducted and I had an alien baby. It all happened while I was up on the ship, and then I came back. It's like, well, they can medically figure that out just from looking at your DNA, your genetics, your blood work, whatever, all that stuff. So I guess the question, tie that back to what I'm asking you, is, like, given your scientific background, like, how easy or difficult would it be to discern if what I brought to you was a piece of a flying saucer? Because I guess a lot of my bone of contention, this is a long and twisting question, but my bone of contention in a way is, like, they made a big deal a year or two ago that, and I saw you were quoted in the Vice article about it, you know, about how they acquired, TGSA acquired some pieces of ARCT's parts. And it's like the fucking ARCT's parts have been around for, like, since 1997 at least, because I was just looking at an old Art Bell episode where they were talking about it with Linda Moulton Howe. So it's like, how do you not know if this is from a flying saucer or not? Like, it's been, like, 30 years. Like, or 25 years, you should know. Like, so that's my question. Is it really that difficult to know if this alleged alien alloys are alien or not? Or is it something that you can just put it under the spectrometer and in 10 minutes you're like, no, this is a tin can?
So it's a really it's a pretty – I actually talk about this. I wrote an article about this specifically and spoke about how would you tell if a piece of material was extraterrestrial in some way? You know, the first way, the simplest way, and this is the way that they always talk about, and it's by far the dumbest way, is to test the isotopic ratios of the material itself. The idea being, the Earth, when it was created, you know, kind of it set in motion a chain reaction of nuclear decay that occurs for unstable materials, right? So, like, you know, uranium is like a common example that we think of, but another one is carbon. Carbon-14 decays, and depending on how much of that carbon-14, like the percentage of carbon-14 there is compared to the rest of the carbon in the material, that ratio tells you approximately how old something is, right? That's
okay.
What radiocarbon dating is. So other planets, though, or other parts of the universe that were created before the Earth have different radioactive isotopic decay rates. Or not decay rates, but they have different decay ratios. So
yeah.
there is a potential that if a material – and this is how we actually test meteorites to see if meteorites are from here or if they are from space or other space debris. The way that we test it is we test the isotope ratios of those materials, and if those materials have a different decay – or if they have different ratios than we'd expect to see on Earth for the different elements that are part of the material, then that is a strong indication that they come from space. So that's the first thing, right? But that doesn't tell you if it's a meteorite or if – you know, there's kind of two questions, right? The first question is, did this thing come from space? Is it not from Earth? The second question is this something that was made by an alien? You know, because stuff falls from space all the damn time. You know,
so that's not
really that exotic. So the second question is really where it gets hard. In the second question, there's kind of a couple of different ways you can think about this. The first one does the material show types of material or what a scientist would call a thermodynamic phase or a crystalline phase, a solid phase, a material phase, whatever you want to call it? Does it show a phase of matter or a phase of material or something like that? Not really a phase of matter, but does it show a thermodynamic phase that we don't expect to find on Earth? So, for example, there are labs in the United States and across the world right now who, when meteorites fall, they take the meteorites, they take them apart into their kind of constituent pieces, and they see if they can find metal alloys that don't exist on Earth. Because some of those alloys are magnetic, and the Earth is running out of magnets. So it's actually like a really big problem, right? We're not really running out of magnets per se, but we're running out of the materials that make good magnets, the rare earth elements. So that's one way that they do this now, is they look to see, is there a thermodynamic phase that can't exist on Earth? So that's one thing. We could check to see if there's a thermodynamic phase that exists in that material that isn't on Earth. On that part of the question, the two of the Stars Academy material that we know of so far has failed, as far as we know, right? Based on it being the Linda Moulton Howe arts parts sample that's been around forever, right? It fails test. It also fails the isotopic ratio test, but that's fine. The kind of second big thing would be, is it in a physical form that we cannot engineer on Earth? Now, what I mean by that is the structure of the material itself. Like, if we looked at this thing under a microscope, under a transmission electron microscope, and found that it was a perfectly crystalline structure that's, you know, built into shapes like a five-pointed star that are really pretty and, you know, whatever, all this other stuff, we might think that's not something that we can make on Earth, right? That's interesting, right?
Yeah.
The problem is that the material isn't like that. In fact, the material is a type of material and a phase of material that we've been able to make consistently since the beginning of electrochemistry, basically.
Yeah.
So the material that they have, has layers of magnesium and bismuth that are seemingly alternating, right? But they are alternating. The layers themselves are micrometers thick, hundreds of micrometers thick. Now, a micrometer is it's about the same thickness as a piece of aluminum foil, approximately, are each of those layers, right?
Huh.
So first off, that tells you a little bit. It's not that interesting, right? But the other part of this that makes it not so interesting is the fact that we have been able to, since the 1950s, generate in a lab materials that have alternating layers of metal or aluminum silicate or whatever at the nanoscale. So, you know, thousands of times smaller than the material that To the Stars Academy has. So in my PhD, that was the materials that I worked on were lamellar structures, layered structures. The materials that I was generating in the lab were alternating layers of 2 nanometer thickness, which means that they are only a couple dozen atoms thick. And there are labs that can do plating of materials that are individual atoms thick. In Boston, there's like a dozen of them. You know, we from our houses, we could throw a rock and probably hit one of those labs. You know what I mean? They're all over the damn place in the Bay State, right?
So, and the funny part is they sound really exciting, but they're almost always like in some fucking office park with a picnic table, and you probably drive by them all the time.
Always, right? They're always next to not your average Joe's. You know, it's always, that business, right?
Exactly.
But so on that front, the To the Stars Academy materials fail spectacularly as well, because they're not even hard to synthesize, right? So besides the fact that these types of materials are made as industrial wastes somewhat frequently, it kind of depends on the process and everything else. And bismuth is a little weird, and you know, so it kind of makes sense that this would be of interest at least. And there's frankly not that many people doing research into layered solids of this sort, because it hasn't been a thing we cared about for a long time. You know, bismuth is very valuable for what it's good at doing, but it up until kind of recently had limited, heavy science interest, right? It was a metal that was produced in industrial refining, and it was created for its ability to alloy with magnesium and pull out lead and all these other things. But, you know, it wasn't really used in high technology until recently. And so the reason that they went from calling these things alloys to calling them metamaterials is, first off, they're technically not alloys because they're not mixtures of metal. They don't, you know, they're not mixtures of metal, right? So an alloy is a different thing, first off.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also not really metamaterials. A metamaterial is any material that has been engineered specifically to alter the photonic or the optical properties of the material. So an example of a metamaterial in at least kind of a simplistic way would be a surface that has been engineered to look red. And not by paint, but like by structure, by diffraction of the light from onto the surface,
yeah.
Like an anodized aluminum. But again, though, that's something that we've known how to do. Like, we're still kind of getting the fundamental understanding of that way that optical, you know, engineering is possible with these materials. But they have no evidence. Those metamaterials are, again, thousands of times smaller than the materials To the Stars Academy is talking about.
Yeah.
You know, to give you an example of kind of the difference in scale. You know, it's like comparing a basketball with a mountain. You know what I mean? That's the difference in scale we're talking about here. They are talking about a material that's the scale of a mountain, and the science community is able to engineer things at the scale of a basketball down to like a golf ball. You know, because we can do single atom deposition now. We can do the growth of single layers of material. Atom by atom.
Yeah. So essentially, I guess that's how you would figure it out.
Well, yeah,
but I guess the question is like, why the fuck is it take? Like, why is it kind of like the sort of thing where it's like you could probably figure it out kind of easily, which is why we haven't quote unquote figured it out yet, because they're just going to keep trying. They're just going to keep running tests. Let's just run a different test on this and see if. Wait another 10 years and we'll run the test again kind of thing. That's kind of partially what I wonder in a way, because, like, it should be fairly cut and dry. I mean, I don't know. I guess, how about this? What would something that came from an alien spaceship. Can you even like fathom what that would like look like to you scientifically? Would it be something that after you ran all these tests, you'd be like, all right, there's no other explanation than that this was manufactured by, you know, an intelligent species from off the planet. There's no other way. Would that even be discernible?
I think it could be. The challenge is, first off, the challenge is, you know, we're talking about, I always think about, when I think about this stuff, that it sometimes feels like we're, you know, we're running before we can even walk. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, we don't even have a good picture of a UFO.
Right, exactly.
You know?
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
So who the hell knows what they're made of, right? Like, people are still arguing that they're psychic projections of the collective unconscious or whatever, you know. So if they're that, then we're never going to get a piece of craft. If we assume that this thing is a, if we assume that it is a physical craft, that it's traveled here through space, that it's able to have intelligent life on board, right? Then you would expect that it would, at the very least, have some kind of heat or radiation shielding on the outer surface, right? Because it has to be able to get through the atmosphere untouched, and it has to be able to do all kinds of physical maneuvers in the atmosphere that, like, just by friction would destroy any other airplane, right?
Yeah.
So you can think then that surface has to have, depending on the part of the ship that we got, right, and I would argue that it's probably more likely that we would get, like, an outer surface, right, if we think about, like, plane crashes. You know, I'm not sure what piece is the most often recovered from a plane crash, but because, you know, for all we know, this might be a piece of alien sofa. You know what I mean?
Right,
like,
right.
This might be a chair on their airplane or their UFO, and we're seeing how, you know, we should be testing for springiness and comfort and not for, you know, thermal properties.
Right, exactly. It's kind of like the idea, like, I forget who the skeptic was, but they were always like, bring me an alien toilet seat and then we'll talk. And it's like, well, what if you did? And you're like, the alien's like, yeah, it's made of fucking plastic, just like yours, dude.
Right.
How else would you make a toilet seat?
Wait, what the hell, man?
Then you're just left with a stolen alien toilet seat and nobody fucking believes you. So who knows?
And now you just look like a pervert, right? Like, you're not a scientist
yeah, exactly.
anymore. No, but that is a really legitimate point, though, right? Like, we're making a lot of assumptions. But if I was in the assuming game, which if you're into UFOs, you are into the assuming game always because we don't know anything.
Right.
I'd say that what I would be searching for are things like extreme heat shielding capabilities. I would be looking for physical strength. Is the material able to withstand? So one of the biggest challenges on Earth about traveling to space is that the shielding for, like, the stuff that you need to protect you from radiation and temperature and pressure and all that other stuff, all that stuff is really heavy. So our ships are really heavy, and so you need a buttload of fuel to get you from point A to point B.
Right.
So although, first off, you would expect that if they have infinite energy to get here, which they would need to get here, then maybe they don't care about the weight of their craft. But I would still think or wager that they've advanced to the point that they are able to create very lightweight, very strong materials. So the first thing I would test is the ability of the material to withstand force, right? Like, can it, you know, how much pressure do you have to apply to it to make it crack? Is it brittle? Is it moldable? Is it really, you know, strong? Does it, how does it transfer heat, right? If it's a shielding component on the outer surface of material, you would expect that it's able to withstand heat very efficiently, right? Maybe the thing is impervious to radar. Maybe it's impervious to gamma radiation. Maybe, you know, so there's all kinds of things you could assume that an alien ship should be able to do. I think the ultimate hallmark would be, and that's what makes this so challenging, is the fact that good science posits a hypothesis, tests that hypothesis, and then uses those results to then further kind of think about what their next test would be, right?
Yeah.
The problem with a lot of this seems to be their initial assumption is this is a piece of UFO material, and they keep testing it in order to get evidence to prove that hypothesis. So they'll never be done because you can't prove a positive, right? Like you can't prove that this is an alien material outside of an alien coming down and saying that's from my ship, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, how do you prove that? So, you know, Karl Popper, the famous philosopher of science, talked about science should be about falsifying claims, not proving them. And so what that means is if they wanted to develop a very good test to say, even if they wanted to test a hypothesis that this is a UFO debris, it's a piece of a UFO craft, they should be developing tests to try and prove that it is not a piece of a UFO craft. And then if none of those tests work, then they're building compelling evidence. But, you know, frankly, though, right now, as far as we know, as far as the public knows, the only test that they've done on these materials are very, very simple. They are scanning electron microscope, which is useless, is frankly a useless – scanning electron microscope in the material science world is one of those tests you add to papers to make them look pretty, but they don't give you any information really. Like maybe about the morphology of your crystals or your materials or stuff like that, but ultimately – if you're working on an advanced material, it's likely a nanomaterial, and therefore SEM won't show you anything interesting at the nanoscale. And then the other tests they've done are isotope ratios, which we've kind of already talked about, but those have limited use as well because, you know, first off, they never do enough tests to get any statistically relevant data, but secondly, the range of isotopes that they're looking at for this sample, they're Earth ranges. You know what I mean? Staking their claim on this thing being alien on like a 2% difference with a margin of error of like, you know, 5%. So it's, you know, it's not exactly a home run.
Right. So it's very difficult to like have a cut and dry unless you have it actually, from the alien, you know, unless you can show that it came from a flying saucer. I like saying flying saucer just to be kind of a dick, I don't care. But
if we could prove that it either had a structure that we couldn't create on Earth, or it had showed properties that there's three things. If it's a phase or type of material we've never seen before, that is immediate proof of something interesting. The second one would be if this material shows a structure or a physical form that we can't replicate on Earth, that would be interesting. The third one would be if this material is able to do things that other materials on Earth can't do, that would also be interesting. Outside of those three things, though, and even with those three things, you can't necessarily say that these were designed by – it could be a part of an experimental aircraft, right?
Right, exactly.
It could always be a piece of Earth tech that, you know, we've just never known about. So, I don't know. It's just a hard – the material – I'm a materials guy. I don't think the materials is ever going to give us the answers we want, you know?
We got to spread this stuff around. Let's put it on the internet.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Great heavens. What kind of radio show is this?